Hello, and welcome to Sounding Out with Izzy, the podcast where we have conversations with musicians, music producers, publicists, live promoters, zine makers, journalists, and more about their experiences working in the music industry as women, non-binary, and queer people. I'm your host, Isabel Korp, the founder of the queer femme music-based blog and YouTube channel, A Girl's Two Sound Sense. Today, I am thrilled to welcome to the Sounding Out studio, Marissa Paternoster, the kinetic front woman of the legendary Screaming Females. It was a total honor to get to speak with Marissa about Screaming Females' brilliant new album, Desire Pathway, which came out this year, as well as the rich DIY and hardcore history of New Jersey, and our shared love for Placebo, among other things. As usual, I would like to remind listeners that I am paying for the podcast out of pocket, so if you would like to help me continue to create more episodes, and maybe buy me a coffee as well, please consider donating to or checking out my Patreon at patreon.com/agirls2soundsense. That's girl with three R's and no I. Those who join my Patreon will get to unlock bonus content, including music-based film reviews with special guests, unheard and unedited conversations in podcast episodes, playlists curated by yours truly, as well as early access to some of my YouTube content. However, I understand that finances are tight for many people, so if you are unable to join the Patreon, I fully understand. All I ask is that you give the podcast a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, as that really helps me out in my effort to get the podcast in front of more people. And without further ado, let's get right into this episode. So for archival purposes, I'm starting off every chat from now on asking my guest if you can state your name, what time it is, and where you are.
My name is Marissa Paternoster. It's 11:58 a.m. and I'm in Brooklyn, New York.
Awesome. Well, welcome. Thanks again for agreeing to come on. I'm very excited. This is going to be the launch episode for season 5 of the podcast. So it's going to be an honor to launch it with someone as legendary to me as yourself. I tried to keep that buried, like when we worked together, when you did that solo set at the Broadway on Halloween. Also as a fun icebreaker, let's talk about Placebo for like 2 minutes. Because I came, like, for those who are unaware, like, because no one listening will know this, I came to work that night, since it was Halloween, dressed as Brian from Placebo, and you were the only person who got it. And I was like, yeah. Aha!
But yeah, I mean, Placebo reference, especially early Placebo, obviously. I was remarking the other day that they're still playing, correct?
Yes, they are.
And they're very, very famous still, mm-hmm. especially in Europe, which I lost track after the third record, I think. I'm glad they're still at it.
Yeah, same here. What was the third record? Was that
Black Market record? Music.
Black Market Music, right.
Yeah, I was reaching for it. I was like, what is it? It had special K's on that one, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a smash hit. Massive hit.
Yeah, it sounds kind of like Dreamin' by Blondie, I realized the other day. I'm not sure if they are in the same key, but they sound pretty similar. Like, grab.
I'll AB it after the podcast.
Dreamin'. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
But so what's going on with you? What's like occupying your life at this moment, this month, this coming spring?
Well, our album came out on February 17th. We celebrated by having 2 shows in Jersey City, which is in New Jersey. We throw a festival every year and we're trying to continue to do so in the future called the Garden Party, where we like curate and organize a show of independent and DIY artists. This year was the first year we did 2 nights, which we haven't ever done before. And we had a day event, which we had never done before. We had an after party. So it was like our biggest kind of lift yet for the garden party. And it went really well. And our new record seems to have been received relatively well by everyone who's heard it. Seems like some new people are getting into the band, which is always cool. And next on Friday, we're going to Alaska for the first time. We met like a cool punk named Jaybird through just like asking a bunch of people on the internet for a connection. We've wanted to play Alaska for so long. And this wonderful person named Jaybird, who's in a band called Termination Dust, basically just like organized a whole tour of Alaska for us. So we're going to be there for about a week. And we're going to go to some places that bands don't typically go, like Talkeetna and Homer. That's what's occupying my mind. A lot of people are like, you got to get like wool underpants or whatever. But my plan is to just, you know, I have some like long johns, but I'm just going to be cold. I think that's my plan. So doing some prep for that. And then when we get home from the tour of Alaska, we're going to do a national tour. And then after the national tour of the States, we're going to go over to Europe and the UK.
That's going to be interesting just to like frequent Alaska for a full week.
I am so lucky and I'm so excited and I can't wait to see what just all the things that Alaska has to offer.
And this new album was recorded with this new album. This is like the first signs that I'm having a stroke, if you can't tell.
No.
The new album was recorded at Pachyderm Studios. Is that how you say it?
It's more pronounced like P-A-C-K.
Like pachyderm?
Yeah, a pachyderm is like an elephant. I think a rhinoceros is a pachyderm. It's like an ungulate is the name for horses and hooved animals. I don't know what makes a pachyderm. We can look it up. But I know like rhinos, hippos, elephants, they're all types of pachyderms, I believe. Or maybe it's just elephants. Should actually look it up.
That sounds very Minnesota. It's in Minnesota, right?
It is in Cannon Falls, Minnesota, correct. Which is about an hour outside of Minneapolis. So it's pretty rural, but it's not far from the city.
Yeah, and I was wondering if you'd like to tell me a little bit of some behind the scenes highlights of recording in like such an iconic location too.
Well, you know, there are a couple touchstones of things that were like really exciting to see if you're a music nerd, which is there's kind of like a famous picture of Steve Albini and Nirvana standing, or they're sitting or kneeling or whatever in front of the fireplace that's in the house that pachyderm is, the whole compound is called pachyderm, but the studio is like on the property. And then there's this big kind of mid-century modern house that we stayed in. And it's a really wild house. So I guess it was kind of like built by the family. I forget what their deal was, but they, you know, they were like a wealthy family who built the house to spec. And it's a really interesting building. The carpet kind of looks like the carpet from The Shining a little bit. It's got like that iconic kind of patchwork and the colors are really similar. But so it was like cool to see the fireplace. And then in the basement, which is probably the weirdest thing about the house, is there's like an in-ground pool. And the pool is like quite small. And it's actually, when you go down into the basement, the pool just looks like black. The water looks black. They painted the concrete inside of the pool this like very dark blue. Or very dark gray, and so it's kind of menacing. And then behind the pool is this kind of, I wouldn't say it's decrepit, but like a sauna that people obviously don't use very much. So definitely the first house I've ever been in that had a pool inside of it and a sauna. But you know, when it comes to recording, unfortunately I don't really have a lot of interesting behind the scenes dirt. I just kind of like, because I do the double duty of like singing and playing guitar, I kind of just get trapped in the studio with Matt, or in this case with Matt Bayless, and work like 12-hour days, and then just I go directly to bed. So the majority of my days were just getting up, eating breakfast. Matt and I went into the studio, we were there for 12 to 14 hours, and then we would go to bed. But I took one walk around the the area, and it seemed really beautiful, but I, you know, unfortunately I didn't really get to amble around town or see much of anything besides the studio, which was beautiful. It's finite, you know, it's like, yeah. we were there for like 2.5 weeks. So it's like, right. We have to get these things done within this time frame. And we always show up very, very prepared with demos and pre-production notes and everything. So we kind of know how things are going to roll out when we are actually in the studio, because like worst case scenario, we don't get everything done. It's not the end of the world, but it's certainly not desirable. So like I said, as much as I'd like to tell you that there's like fun gossipy kind of little stories to tell you about recording, it's just never really happened to us because we're always on like a really tight schedule and we have to make sure everything gets done. So it's just working and sleeping.
And this was a fun question I put down. If you were to go back in time and make a mixtape for your 12-year-old self, who would be the biggest artists on that mixtape?
I actually got a mixtape, weirdly, I was in like 13 or 14, from my therapist's daughter, who is working for Rolling Stone. And I guess when I was 14 and I was in therapy, which, bless my parents' hearts, I guess I wouldn't shut up about music. I'm sure my therapist wanted me to talk about something else, but I didn't have any other prevailing interests besides like Radiohead B-sides and like whatever was happening with the new Zwan record or something. Or like, so I guess she noticed that like I just wouldn't shut up about music, and her daughter happened to be working for Rolling Stone, and she made me a little mixtape, and it like, I wish I could get in touch with her somehow. I'm sure I could, but it just like completely changed my life. And I feel like I actually got the mixtape that I would have given to teenage me. It had like Pixies on it and Slater Kinney and like Yola Tango and Pavement and just like all the cool stuff that I wound up actually really gravitating towards on my own. But yeah, I mean, that tape really, really rocked my world.
Nice. And you still have it?
No, I wish I still had it. It got like eaten up, I mean, you know, by life. But I remember the Slater Kinney song, I think was Burn Not Don't Freeze.
Oh, that. Yeah, I love that song.
And yeah, that like, I was just like, this is changing my life. Yeah, Burn Don't Freeze was on it.
The call and response on that song is so good.
Yeah, and the Pixie song was gigantic. And that was the band, and that like really, I think, changed my life in high school. I just didn't really listen to anything else.
Yeah, that's cool that you mentioned Slater Kinney and also the Pixies, because like I feel like the way you play guitar is a very distinctive style, like that could only come from you, if that makes sense. And it's kind of the same way that Carrie Brownstein's style of guitar playing has just been like, I don't know, codified as like specifically Carrie Brownstein core, if that makes sense. Like the way she plays is like so distinct and like skilled and very specific. Like, and I mean, I don't know if I'm totally making no sense right now, but also like Kim Deal, the way she plays bass is just like very like, I don't think there's a better bass player on this earth than Kim Deal, if I'm being totally honest.
Agreed. Yeah, I mean, like, I think that players like Joey Santiago from Pixies and, like you mentioned, Carrie Brownstein have really signature tones and, like, patterns to the way that they play. And I had just started playing guitar and I was interested in it, and I really liked Smashing Pumpkins, so I did like some like really guitar driven music that was had a lot of leads in it and solos and stuff. But the music that I feel like really changed my life and made me realize that I could be in a band were bands like the Pixies and Slater Kinney, because they seemed like everyday people, like you and me people, and especially somebody like Kim Deal, who is kind of like one of the first, you know, of course, not to circle back, Darcy Retzky was in Smashing Pumpkins, but like Kim just seemed more like to 13-year-old me, more like somebody that I might know in my day-to-day life. And she did something that I thought that maybe I might be able to do someday. And with these like monolithic kind of gigantic bands, like the Pearl Jams and like the Nirvanas and the Smashing Pumpkins, the music that I was interested in, that didn't seem accessible at all. It was just completely beyond like any scope of what I could achieve. And then when I learned about Riot Girl and punk and DIY through bands like Slater Kinney and the Pixies, I was really galvanized into like being in a band. And I was like, I don't have to play like Eric Clapton. Like I can play however I play, and people might like appreciate that if I'm lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it definitely shows. And I was wondering if you wanted to tell me a little bit about coming up in the New Jersey sort of DIY basement scene, because New Jersey continues to fascinate me as such a breeding ground for like a lot of DIY music.
Yeah, I mean, when we started playing in New Brunswick, New Jersey, aside from the really strong impulse to like play essentially rock music or loud, you know, punk music, we were really inspired by DIY and cultivating community. So I think punk for us meant so much more than just music. It meant creating spaces where people could spend time with each other and share their ideas with each other and party with each other and like, you know, become friends. And so many of those friendships that I made when I was, you know, 20 in New Brunswick are still friendships that I have today. And aside from us like having touring bands come through New Brunswick and celebrating music from all over the country and all over the world, all of the people who kind of like put on shows or had homes that hosted shows, we lived together, you know. It's so much more than just the show. It's like living together, traveling together, just it's all encompassing. It's going to school together, all kinds of stuff. It's a small scene for sure. I think I've talked about this like at length a bunch of times, but a lot of New Brunswick is Rutgers University. Obviously, it's a gigantic university, and so they own for all intents and purposes, a lot of New Brunswick, and then there's a bunch of hospitals and a bunch of parking decks for the hospitals, and there's just like no all ages space for people to gather in. And because of that, young people who are underage or just wanted to have a place to put on a show just have shows in their basements. And it's still going on to this day. And I suppose, and it was happening prior to my arrival in New Brunswick, although I will say that prior to my time at Rutgers, it seemed like there were way more bars that had all ages shows and there were venues that had shows. But as you know, gentrification pushes places like that out, it becomes prohibitively expensive to have institutions like that, which is really a shame because people need it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I feel like we're seeing that happen just everywhere, that it's so disheartening to see. Like, I spoke to a musician who moved away from Nashville in like 2 or so hours, like out into the country in Tennessee, because she was like, Nashville's too expensive for me now. Like, I can't afford to pay Silicon Valley prices. And I was like, yep, it sounds like every major city is just succumbing to late capitalism and gentrification. It's incredible the rate that it's going, like, and it's like also really scary.
Yeah, I mean, if history shows us anything, it tells us that art is the first thing to go. And art and the institutions that support it are usually the first things to go in favor of profit. And so New Brunswick is just another victim of that. And when, you know, for example, the football team became very successful, professors at my art school were being terminated. More and more parking garages were getting put up and millions of dollars were invested in the football coach and the stadium. And none of that money was given to the arts. And
gross, 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 gross. I hate it.
It just doesn't make any sense because they just have so much money, and kids want it. They want to have like that space. But with that being said, you know, like the freedom that the basement scene lends to the students and the people who live in New Brunswick is like invaluable, and has taught me personally so much about being able to put on a show and like just take care of stuff myself and not have to have my hand held by an institution or a university to teach me how to kind of function in the real world. And so even for all of its shortcomings and all the stuff I just said, I am really grateful that I did have the experience that I had in New Brunswick, because it made me a very capable person.
Definitely. DIY is the way to go usually, because you can rely on your own independence and you don't have to rely on like someone else funding you. I think that's the big thing about like, I don't know, how do you feel about like when you see peers of yours go and be like, oh, we're being courted by all these major labels, why don't we sign? It shouldn't be that bad. Like, do you feel like it always goes south after that?
I really don't have any skin in that game, to be honest. And people right. should do whatever they want to do that they think is best for their project. But personally, if I was like a new emerging artist that was being courted by some labels that wanted me to hire a manager or spend money that I didn't have to necessarily spend on my project, I would probably say no. And, you know, there's unfortunately, it's not just making music. It's not just making art. Sometimes you do have to consider something as grotesque as money to be able to keep your project afloat. And if you're a developing artist and you're just learning how to do the damn thing, learn how to do it before you have someone else do it for you, so they don't take advantage of you. It would be my advice, because unfortunately, there are people out there who are going to probably want to latch on to you while, you know, strike while the iron is hot. We didn't have that problem, really. So I never had to worry about it. But learning is fun and cool. Knowing what's going on is fun and cool. Being confident is fun and cool. So I would definitely, you know, recommend doing it yourself up until a point, until you feel like maybe you can't handle it anymore and you do need help. And at that point, you'll probably know enough about your craft to be able to make more informed decisions about how you want to proceed.
Yeah. How did you go about, I guess, sort of really getting a hold of the business side of things?
I remember that, you know, Screaming Females is more than just me. It's Mike and Jarrett are involved in every decision that is pertaining to the band and what we do in our life together. And I know that Jarrett one time got a really kind of important email from Steve Albini that changed his life. And Steve is a wonderful person who at that point was not a friend of ours, but now is. And I think there was like a very small label who was either offering us something, who knows what, maybe they wanted to put out a record. I really don't even remember. It was so long ago, but Steve essentially just gave us. So Jarrett emailed Steve and was like, hey, I'm in this punk band. We self-release our records. We put on our own shows. There's this small label that's interested in putting out our records. May I please have some advice? And Steve wrote back a very thoughtful email, basically telling me what I just told you, which is just like, if you don't really need the extra help right now and you feel capable doing what you're doing and you're just starting out and you're still just learning, then let yourself learn. Give yourself that freedom. If you're not completely overwhelmed by what's like coming at you and you don't need help, then you just don't need some auxiliary source essentially taking your money. You might need that money to buy a van to go on tour, buy an amp, like make your new record. You know, like you can handle so much more probably than you think. But yeah, I never read a book about the music business, but I would say that everything that I've learned about the music business has been learned through just experience. And, you know, Screaming Females has probably played 1400 shows at this point and been all over the world. And I've met thousands and thousands of people, and we're on our eighth studio record, and experience is invaluable. Really.
And you released your first record in like 2006, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, but we started in 2005.
Yeah, so that's like 18 years almost that you've been active.
Yeah.
So what would you say you're super grateful for, like, throughout your run, like, looking back on everything right now, especially after COVID-19 lockdown?
I'm so grateful for all of the experiences that I've had. I don't think I would have been to 99% of the places I've been on the planet if it wasn't for Screaming Females. And I don't think I would have ever really learned how to be maybe sociable and if it wasn't for Screaming Females. I'm an only child. I was very afraid of the world when we first started. I had never really been anywhere or done much of anything. And so Screaming Females and touring full-time really taught me how to put myself out there and to not be so afraid. And I'm grateful for all the friends that I've made. You know, it's an amazing feeling to be able to go to almost any state and be able to call somebody if I need help or I want to hang out or I need a place to stay or something. And I'm so grateful to have this like extended family beyond my nuclear like blood family with Mike and Jarrett, who are two people that I literally can rely on probably until the day I die, which is something a lot of people don't have.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I feel like when you're just packed in a van together for months at a time, that's a type of relationship that you wouldn't be able to build with anyone otherwise. Like it's like a sort of like almost magic sort of bond.
It's super heavy in like the emotion in an emotional sense. And it's hard to put into words and describe to people because I feel like being in a band for 18 years is a touring band for 18 years is a very unique experience and not something that you can share with a lot of people. And when you do, you're just like, ah, you get it. That's so fun. Like we just did a tour with Touche Amore, who are a band from LA, and they've been a band I think for like 15 years. Basically the same lineup, and there was a camaraderie that I felt there that was really an interesting feeling to feel. I had never really like recognized that it is pretty rare for a DIY touring band or like a punk band to be around with a consistent lineup for such a long time.
Yeah. I'm curious about what you think about the current state of the music industry and how women and queer people are like sort of able to acclimate to the current climate of the industry. Do you think it's still like a work in progress, would you say?
I mean, yeah, you know, we started playing in 2005 and I can only speak to my experience. And there were a lot of women participating in the New Brunswick music scene, but we were still the minority. And queer people were still the minority, and that's still the case today. But it's definitely better. there are more queer identifying people and women and non-binary people who are playing punk rock and participating in DIY, and it's beautiful and wonderful to see. I mean, I wouldn't have it any other way. How else can I extrapolate on that? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, I've been really lucky to be in the band that I'm in. And we always kind of, especially when I was young, you know, Riot Girl and the kind of ideology that backed it was always a touchstone for me and what I would talk about when I talked about music and what got me into music. So I think even though our music isn't really inherently political, although sometimes there are some lyrics that are, if you're getting thrown on a stage and being put in front of an audience, you ought to have something to say. And I think that playing as a feminist and identifying as, you know, or being very out and queer and unapologetic about it was definitely like on my agenda when it came to being a performer and is a big part of why I wanted to be in a band. And when I talk to young queer people and they tell me that Screaming Females has been a big part of their life or has helped them through a difficult period or maybe made them feel less alone, I feel like I have done kind of my younger self a service because I had bands that did that for me and I know how invaluable and important that is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like it's definitely invaluable for the kids who are looking for something beyond what they see in mainstream circles, which is so great that we have the internet to make that so easy too. Because especially like in the mainstream pop world, like a lot of the queer artists that are being like heavily marketed in the media aren't necessarily holding guitars. So
I'm in my mid 30s. So I grew up with commercialized feminism too. And it wasn't the worst thing in the world. You know, like the Spice Girls weren't the worst thing in the world. Having the Spice Girls tell me it's okay to be a girl. It's okay to be proud to be a girl. You don't have to be ashamed of it. You can revel in your femininity or reject it or do whatever you want. Of course, the Spice Girls were a pop group that was put together to make money, but 12-year-old me didn't know that. As I got older, though, of course, the Spice Girls weren't speaking to me anymore, and I needed something more relatable and maybe more profound, and that's when Riot Girl came into my life and changed my life, and now I get to do what I've loved the most for a living, so.
Yeah. And you got to tour with the Julie Ruin. Like, did you feel like that was, like, a full circle moment when you got to do that, like, however long ago it was?
Yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of full circle moments at this point, and, you know, getting to, like, talk to Kathleen Hanna was just one of them, and I can't say enough about how much she means to me or how much her music means to me, or just being able to, like, call her a friend of mine means to me. It's like, beyond words.
Absolutely. I feel like that warmth just sort of emanates. Like, you can sense the vibes. The vibes are there that she's, yeah, a very intuitive and very, like, important. I read an interesting quote from her where she said that Bikini Kill was sort of like her way of screaming at the world from a feminine experience. And then with La Tigra and Julie Ruin, she wanted her focus to be more on speaking to other women, which I thought was really cool.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think that's interesting and speaks to how adept of a listener she is as an artist. She's like listening to the world around her all the time. And I think in the early 90s, you know, when Bikini Kill existed, you did need a more confrontational band to tell, you know, maybe for guys to back off at shows and get women to come out to punk shows and hardcore shows and get them in the front and tell them that they are welcome there. And this is an inclusive space for women and queers and POC. And then in the early 2000s, as, you know, women did become more of a part of the DIY scene, it was a time to, like, I wouldn't say celebrate is the right word, but just acknowledge that the progress that had been made. And I would say La Tigra is very celebratory music while also being really radical and political. And yeah. And she's, you know, she's listening to the world around her and making music as a response to that.
Definitely. And do you remember that meme that was going around of just like a woman like yelling in a man's ear?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I guess I referenced that to say that Jessica Hopper tweeted that picture and then like wrote in all caps something like, so Lilith Fair grosses like however many trillion dollars. So the execs have to invent adult alternative to silo these women on the radio. And then that's how we end up with Woodstock 99 or something like that. Something really funny. But I guess I referenced that to say that sometimes like this communal just sense of solidarity are so important. We needed like a reaction against like the hyper masculine energy at shows that was harmful and stuff like that. And
yeah, I mean, I think creating, yeah. You know, I don't think Riot Girl was trying to create exclusive spaces that were only for women and queer people. But of course, there, you know, there are tales about shows where men had to pay more or they just simply couldn't come. But having, you know, if you think of the show kind of like as a performance piece or like a happening, it's putting an exclamation point on a sentence. It's like just illuminating that there is a problem. Look at this problem. Have you ever seen this many women listening to a hardcore band before or going to a DIY show before? Like being like moshing or being aggressive or not holding their boyfriend's coat, et cetera, et cetera. Like maybe you haven't seen that and it's never even come to mind that you go to a hardcore show and you don't see any like non-binary people or outwardly queer people or people of color. And so I think having those shows was just being like, look, there's a problem. We need to talk about this. I don't think they were trying to tell men, cis men, that they weren't necessarily welcome. They were just trying to illuminate that there's a serious issue. Women want to come to shows. They want to participate in arts and culture. They don't want to be marginalized anymore. And so let's chat about it. Let's make it better.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's confrontational. A lot of men are going to take it the wrong way and get defensive because I'm sure that they felt like they were being attacked personally, which is an immature reaction to have to like a very valid point.
Yeah. When like you're so used to being entitled that like, I don't know, like being asked to take a step back feels like you're being oppressed. Like that's when you know there's a real problem.
Yeah. I mean, all, you know, I feel like at the end of the day, when issues like this come up, cool, calm, calculated conversation can almost always be had, but it's not going to be everybody's initial reaction to being called out on their shit.
Right. I remember a friend of mine went to see some of her friends on tour when they both happened to be in the same state. And this band was a group of all men. And the lead singer spoke with her after. And he was like, yeah, can we get like really real about the scene for a second? And she was like, okay, all right. You want to get real? Okay. Mm-hmm. You need to put more women on the shows you're booking. And he was like, oh God, are you? And she was like, well, you wanted to get real about the scene, right? And he was like, yeah, but not about me. Like, but it's so interesting to see that, like, just like it really like being caught off guard reaction. But that's what you do. Like that, like she still considers this person her friend and you hold your friends accountable. And so like, I think that was really, and I would hope that he took that to heart and was more mindful of being inclusive. I hope, but I think that's very important to do.
Yeah. And to circle back on something that I said earlier, you know, I know we're focusing on DIY and punk, but like the show itself is just a reflection of your social circle at large. So who do you surround yourself with? Are you a straight white man who doesn't have any like platonic girlfriends? Are you a straight white man who doesn't have any friends who are people of color or come from different classes? You know, there are so many different iterations of life that can be lived by people, and it's really important to acknowledge and celebrate them so that you're not walking blindly through life.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. And I was wondering if I could ask you a little bit about the solo record that you made during pandemic times and I guess how it came about.
It's not the most exciting story, I'm sorry to say. Screaming Females was on tour with a band called Pup from Canada, and the tour got cut short because of the pandemic and we didn't know what was happening. We had just been in Seattle and like, which was, if you remember, one of the initial kind of like hot spots for COVID. So we were lucky enough to get a flight home, and my family at the time still owned my grandmother's house, who had recently passed away. And because of the pandemic and stuff, we were just like, you know, you're not in the market to sell a house at that moment. So I didn't know if I could go home to my roommates. I didn't want to get anyone sick. I also wanted to be close to my father, who's, you know, up there in years. And I didn't know if he could go to the supermarket safely or do anything. So I was staying put at grandma's house, and the house had nothing in it, like, you know, barely any furniture. But I had all my recording equipment in the basement still, and I had my guitar, obviously. So I was just like riding my bike around the suburbs every day with my little dog. And started recording little ideas when I got home. And I don't remember like why my friend Andy came to mind. I think I've just always admired Andy as a musician. He plays guitar. His primary kind of musical project is a band called Bow from Baton Rouge. And we've gone on tour with them. And he's just a sweetheart. We have a lot in common in terms of like the kind of music that we really are drawn to. So, and I knew he did some home recording. So I sent Andy like a track of just some guitar and singing, and I asked him if he wanted to put some crap on it. And he put some beautiful crap on it, and he sent it back to me. And I thought the whole process was like pretty fun and chill. And, you know, Lord knows I wasn't really going anywhere in the foreseeable future. So Andy and I just kind of wrote as quarantine continued up until we had a batch of songs. And then I got my friend Shauna Polly involved to sing, and then Kate Wakefield, who's a cellist and a singer, Ohio, to play cello. She's in a band called Lung, who are very fabulous, who you should check out. And that's kind of it. My friend Eric mixed it all. Eric's been my friend and is a professional engineer in New Jersey. He's been my friend for 16 years, so almost as long as Screaming Females has existed. And, you know, we were all trapped at home and had little home recording rigs and made a record.
Okay, this is another funny random question. Are you a person who listens to podcasts at all?
Yeah, I oscillate towards like only listening to podcasts, but being like, I'm only like, I gotta stop with these things because they're distracting me from being an active music listener and learning about new music. But the answer is yes. We listen to a lot of Bandsplain on tour.
Yeah, she's amazing. I love Bandsplain.
Yeah. I think she's really cool and funny. I also just like how much she just loves the things she loves. It's very relatable.
Yeah, speaking of like Bandsplain and stuff like that, another podcast I really like, it's another Ringer podcast, 60 Songs That Explain the 90s. I listened to the one he did on The Prodigy.
I would say I think The Prodigy is a smart, smart group. Like there are some really dorky YouTube videos you can watch of how they constructed a lot of those songs, and it's like mind-blowing amounts of work and just like just crazy, crazy dorky engineer stuff to make those bangers.
I do enjoy The Fat of the Land for sure.
It's great. Yeah.
And I think Liam Howlett's probably like a misunderstood genius who says a lot of stupid shit.
Oh yeah, I don't know anything about any not tell you the names of anyone in The Prodigy or a word that's ever come out of any of their mouths, but I do celebrate the music.
Yeah, exactly. It's better that way, honestly. Every time I Google something about one of my favorite musicians, I'm like, why did I do that?
Yeah, don't do it.
I saw a funny tweet the other day that said, the 1975 sounds so much better when you stop look at why Maddie Healy's trending on Twitter.
I don't know what the 1975 is.
You're better off.
I've seen the numbers put together in history books and also I think in music news, but I have no idea what they are or who they are or what they sound like.
Oh my God, that is so perfect. That is going to be the soundbite. Just you going, I have no idea what the 1975 is.
I really don't know. Maybe I'll check it out after the podcast.
But also, I guess, when it comes to touring and everything, how do you feel you've navigated, I guess, the, like, just sort of emerging from quarantine sort of climate?
You know, basically all the musicians got kettled into all wanting to tour at the same time because we haven't been working for 2 years. And that's the most viable form of income for pretty much any musician in any kind of, like, class bracket or whatever you want to say. But like a lot of gig workers, it's not just musicians, anybody who's an independent contractor, just there's not a lot of cushion for us when things get really bad. And so my job was completely and abruptly taken away from me, and I had no fallback plan, which is my fault. But it's also a culmination of faults. It's not just mine. It's also the fact that, like, you know, we're not provided with any kind of, like I said, like a cushion to to help us through these rough times. So everyone who's an independent contractor or gig worker had to figure out how to make do. And now that the floodgates are open again, everyone's trying to tour at the same time because we have to. And it's been really difficult to navigate the world of touring. If you're talking about safety, if you're talking about securing venues, making sure the people at your show feel like they're not, you know, in a super spreader event, the way that people kind of have been dealing with COVID varies by region. And it's very noticeable when you travel 300, 400 miles a day and you want to make sure that, you know, you're doing the right thing. It's all about like harm reduction and making sure that you're not part of the problem, you're part of the solution. And it's still very much a work in progress, I would say. You know, it's been hard and scary, but it's something that we have to learn how to live with.
Yeah, definitely. And also, like, that's something that really, like, sucks when it comes to an industry as fickle as one that's, like you said, like, when, how you said earlier, like, art is always the first thing to go. How there's, like, nothing, like, imagine if there was HR or, like, I don't know, paid time off for musicians.
Yeah.
Like, imagine a world where that could be possible, like, or, like, that type of, yeah, what was that?
It would be very weird to experience, for sure.
Yeah. And before we wrap up, I wanted to, which I totally forgot to ask in the beginning when I mentioned Placebo, what's your favorite Placebo single?
I'm just going to say Every Me and Every You.
Oh, yeah.
That's it. Yeah. I don't know if it was a single, though.
Because it was in Cruel Intentions, too.
Okay. So it was definitely a single.
It was definitely a single. Yeah.
Yeah. That's my favorite, hands down.
Yeah.
It's a great track.
So good. I have no idea what mine would be. Probably something like Without You, I'm Nothing, actually.
It's an incredible song, too.
The one they got Bowie to sing on and re-released. That's also incredible. And before we wrap up, do you have anything else that you'd like to shamelessly plug?
Just that our new album, Desire Pathway, is out and that we're going on tour. And so if you like the album or you hate it and you want to come tell me it sucks, buy tickets to the show and come see us.
Exactly. If you're going to tell me it sucks, pay me first.
Tell me in person. You don't even have to pay me. I'll put you on the guest list.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Marissa. This was a blast.
Got it. Yeah. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to Sounding Out with Izzy. And thank you again to Marissa Paternoster for joining me this episode. Remember to subscribe and sign up for the mailing list on my YouTube channel and written blog, both under the name A Girl's Two Sound Sense. Give the podcast a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're interested, consider donating to my Patreon at patreon.com/agirls2soundsense. That's girl with 3 R's and no I. Thank you so much for listening, and I will catch you in the next episode of Sounding Out with Izzy.